Accession number 22077, Reel 8.
So it's Harold Morris Metcalf, Reel 8. So you're in Burma, war is imminent, it's 1938, yeah. Coming on to 1939.
Right.
Yeah. And they called up the territorials.
Right.
Okay, so what was going on at that time?
Well, a couple of things I'd forgotten to say. I would like to put it in as a matter of interest. We had a very good swimming team in the regiment, and the Kulkine Club, or the civilians in Rangoon, invited us to have a polo match and a swimming match. Well, when we got there, we played polo and beat them 2-0. They were a bit surprised at this, don't get me wrong, but, and then they said, righto, we'll have this 8 lengths race with the four of us, and we'll give you half a length start. And I can see my chum, Nibs Merritt and John Jarvis, sort of smiling. We beat them by a whole length, and there was hell to play. But that, you know, this is one of the little things that crops up. And then we had a very serious effort. We had an intelligence section, nothing to do with us. It was from the civil police. And there was always some kind of trouble with the Pongis. I know, you know, they're the Buddhist priests. They wear these saffron robes. And on this particular occasion, this man came to the regiment and he said to the colonel, we're a bit worried about the Pongis. They always carry their umbrellas up. Lately, they have been going to the Swedagon Pagoda with them down, and we think they're carrying weapons. We'd like it checked. Well, it was all right. D Company were sent down to the Swedagon Pagoda, and they went in and found an awful lot of weapons, and there was a big stink about it. Unfortunately, they didn't take their boots off when they went into this sacred shrine, and it was all over the Bristol newspapers how the Gloucesters had defiled the temple. My mother told me about that later. The other thing was, I hadn't long been the drum major, and we had a new RSM. The other chap had gone home, and we had this new chap. His name was Niblett, Pete Niblett. Quite a nice chap, but he could be very officious, very officious. And I had been to playing at a funeral with the band and drums, and the band sergeant and I, Smudger Smith and I, were late for this special sergeant's mess meeting. And when we got back, he said, did it all go well? And we said, yes, thank you. And then he said, the dance on Saturday week, I don't want any of these Anglo-Indian girls here, you know. And of course, a lot of the chaps were friendly with Burmese or Anglo girls. And he said, I'm just going to ask you who you're bringing so that I can vet them. And he went round, you see, and I thought, what am I going to say? Who are you bringing, drum major? I'm bringing the brigadier's daughter, said I, you see. And there was a deathless hush, and he said, are you joking? And I said, no, sir. And I did it spontaneously. I knew the brigadier's daughter because I was a rover knight, our scout group, and she used to take the guides, and they were next to us. So I knew her reasonably well, but she was engaged to my adjutant. So immediately came outside and Smudger said, is it serious, Mick? I said, well, it will be if I can't get permission. I went to the adjutant, Captain Middleton West, and I explained the case to him, and he was rather amused about it. And he said, what are you going to do now then, Mick? I said, well, is it all right with you, sir? He said, oh, certainly. The RSM, although he was the RSM, he was not liked very much. However, I went over to the brigadier's house. He lived quite a mile away, and his wife answered the door, and I said, is the brigadier in, and is your daughter? Oh, yes, come in. I knew them because they played tennis near us. And I went in, and I spoke to, I said, may I speak to your daughter? And he said, yes, we're coming to the dance, you know, drum major. I said, yes, I know, sir. That's what I've come about. And he was there when I said to her, I made a bit of a faux pas this morning. The RSM was officious about this. And I said I was going to bring the brigadier's daughter. I said, so I've already seen your fiancée. And he said, well, you better go and see her. And she said, oh, I think it's a wonderful idea, or words to that effect. So the brigadier said, can you come over here at 7 o'clock? The dance was at 7:30, and you can come with us. So when we arrive at the sergeant's mess, the RSM opens the door and who walks out? I'm sorry, but it was all round the regiment, you know. I mean, I only danced with her a couple of times and just went. But that was just one of those incidents that I thought might make a little bit of fun.
So now, can I just ask
yes?
was this the first time that there'd been this sort of division about, oh, you shouldn't be mixing with the Anglo-Indian girls?
No.
It's been going on, presumably.
Quite a few of our chaps were married to Anglo-Indian girls. And they lived outside because they were not, at that time, they were so, it wasn't done. You know what I mean? It wasn't done. Quotes.
So there'd always been a sort of division.
Yeah, there always was. And I mean, some of the Anglo-Indian girls were a damn sight better than some of the women we had in barracks, but that's another story. Julia's, you see, my wife, her dad was a soldier. I mean, they were British. They weren't Anglos. And so the RSM was quite, he had a thing about this, you know. He didn't like these people. I don't know why, whether he'd been let down somewhere or other, we didn't know. But
or whether it was racism. I mean,
exactly. It quite, there was, and I must say this now, when we went to India, it was non-est. You were not allowed to mix with the Indians at all. They were the lesser breed, you know what I mean, truly. And my one colonel we had, I mean, I saw him whip an Indian once for getting in front of his horse, you know, that sort of thing. It was done. And then we had this problem. We were sent from our barracks to Sale Barracks, which was in the town. We knew something was imminent. I don't know if I have already mentioned that our families had been evacuated.
No, I don't think
so. Our families were sent away to the Koyde Regiment, who were in the hills. We were very pleased. All our stuff was packed under our married quarters stairs, and we were, well, you'll be back soon, sort of, but we never saw it again, of course, but we were upset because we'd only been married a couple of years, and we had all our wedding presents all ready to go home, you know. However, it took us a while. Our barracks were 11 miles from Rangoon, and I used to go in with the regimental dance band to sing, and the chap in charge, Max, I've just forgotten his other name, he was an Anglo-Indian, very, very nice man, and he asked me if I'd sing three songs once a month, and he'd give me £3 for it, which was quite a lot of money then, and of course, I was very pleased because I was saving up to get married, and I did one with the band and three songs by myself. And Julie and I, of course, it used to take at least 8 to 10 days to get a letter response from Madras, and we decided we'd marry on the 8th of May when I obtained permission from my colonel, because you had to get permission to get married in those days. And everything went well, but I didn't have the money to go to Madras and back. But Julia's grand aunt, who was quite a well-off person, she paid for me to go and for both of us to come back. It was her wedding present to us, actually. So, and I was sent for by the colonel, and he said, Major Bagot was my officer commanding company, and he said to me, you're going to duty, Metcalf. And I didn't understand this, because bandsmen and drummers never went to duty unless they'd done something wrong. So I was a bit taken back, and I said, can I be told the reason why? He said, no, you just get up there and report to the Sergeant Major Dutton. And I did, and Tom Dutton said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I really don't know, Tom. I played rugby with him, the Sergeant Major. And so anyway, the thing went, I stayed with the company for a while, and I had awful troubles to start off. I knew nothing about machine guns at all. And then it was all worked out beforehand, which I didn't know about. But I was made corporal the same day, and then I went down the river with the company, where we dug in and so on and so forth for various exercises. And I was due to sing at a concert in Rangoon, my first concert. I phoned up and said, will someone bring my evening dress down to the city hall, blah, blah, blah. And yes, that was all arranged. And the day I had to go back, it poured with rain. And I remember the ferry was open. I had khaki drill with my sidearm on my bayonet. And I was absolutely soaking wet. And on the way down, the other ferry was going down the river. And someone said, hey, Mick. They called me Mick. And it was Corporal Moorfield, who had been a boy with me. And I said, what's up, Jack? He's on the other ferry going. He said, you have to report to the colonel as soon as you get back. So I went to the city hall. My clothes didn't turn up. My first concert in Rangoon, I was, you know what I mean. If you've ever seen a khaki uniform, when it's the khaki drill uniform soaking wet. And I went on and sang, and I had a wonderful evening. I really did. And it went down like a bomb. But the fact was, there was a lady and gentleman there, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, we would like you very much to come to my home. Now, he was an Indian, a doctor, and I had to get permission from my boss to do this later on, and I didn't go for some while. And a chap came back one day, and he said, I met a doctor today, he said, will you tell Mr. Metcalf we would very much like to see him? So on the Sunday, I went down there to his home in Rangoon, and these are things that come back to me in the most strange way. He had three daughters, his wife and their three daughters, Madeline, Gwendolyn and Pat. I've met two of them since I came out of the army. But Madeline was like a coloured Madeline Carroll. She was very, very pretty. And we were all very friendly for a while. And then I was singing along, and then I stopped and I said to her, Mum, where did you learn to play the piano? And she said, in Madras. I said, oh, you Madras? She said, yes. I said, what's your name? She said, Minnie Melchizedek. And the name rang a bell with me somehow. And I said, who taught you? And she said, a Miss Jones in Vepry. Miss Jones was my wife's auntie, you know. And so as a result of that, we became very friendly before we got married, this was. And
so when did you actually get married? You got married on May the 8th?
May the 8th, 1940.
1940, right. So the war has started.
Yes, and we couldn't come home. We had to get married there, you see. That was the point. Right.
And the war in the East hadn't really...
not come to us yet,
right,
no.
Okay. Can you tell me, you know, where you got married, and can you describe that? It was in Madras, was it?
Yes, I got permission from my colonel. I went over in my regimentals and sash and all that to get insured and so on. But the regiment did that for me. And there were 300 guests, none of mine, of course, because I didn't even have a best man. He was a friend of mine from the church that I had known before. And I sang because they asked me to. And we stayed in a friend's house.
Where was the wedding? Was it a church, was it?
Our wedding was at Georgetown Methodist Church, where we had worshipped before. Right. And
so your wife's people had been living in India for a long time?
Yes, oh yes. After her dad died, mother was a nurse, and she stayed on. And her aunt was a music teacher.
Yeah.
So they stayed on, and the girls were in the military school, the three of them.
Her father had been in the army.
He was a staff sergeant in the Royal Engineers. And in fact, when he came out of the army, he worked on all the tram depots in Madras as a civil engineer. He died out there very suddenly, apparently, before. I don't think Julie does remember him, but not very well. And the wedding, it was a trip, a treat. We stayed in our friend's house, and unfortunately, when our wedding day was 105 in the shade. So when I got to church, I had stood on the table to get into my trousers in the morning, because they'd all start stiff. And by the time I got to church, they were flapping about all over the place, sweaty, you know. And I was, when we got home from the church, we went back to my friend's house, and You're going to sleep, of course. The fan wouldn't go. And I knew they had gone to bed because we were sleeping and we were talking about various things. And we sweated the night through. And Earl came in the morning. That was the name, Earl Saville. And he came in the morning and said, "Why haven't you got the ruddy fan on?" I said, "It won't go." And he said, "Oh, didn't they tell you?" And he got this broom and he knocked it. And I never forgot it. You know, these silly things. Anyway, we stayed there a few days. And then I came back to Rangoon for our honeymoon. We stayed with a staff sergeant, Leppard, who became a colonel subsequently in the Indian Army. And I had, during the time we were on leave with him, I had to go back to barracks. They sent for me for a certain parade they wanted the drum major on. So I went back and we settled down in quarters. Very nice married quarter we had. And I'd had, a lady from the music society had given me a pup for a wedding present, a Labrador cross it was. We called him Fluke because they only bred thoroughbreds, and this one was out night in Shazi, as we used to call it. And but he grew into a wonderful animal. And, well, we had no children at the time. You can just imagine everything was... When I used to broadcast, my wife told me the first night he was going all around the house looking for me, you see. And
so you used to broadcast as well?
Yeah, twice a month. BFN, British the Rangoon Forces Broadcast. And, I went with the band once a month and went by myself once a month. In fact, Mrs. Lazarus used to come and play for me sometimes. And then we did quite a lot of... Julie played tennis quite well, and we played tennis every morning. And... before I went on parade, actually. And we regularly went to the Lazarus's house on a Sunday for tea, and they'd bring us back in their car. And things began to get sticky during that. We had trouble with the natives, you know, at various times.
So and what sort of trouble? Were they kicking against the British rule?
They were indeed, yes.
What do you think sparked that?
It was Gandhi when he came over that time, because we had to push him back straight away. I think that's what it was anyway. But there are always little incidents, and we called internal security duties. We were sent out.
Can you remember any of those incidents?
Yes, I can indeed. Very rarely the band went out. They didn't like the band and drums to go, if it was possible. But we went on two occasions, and I don't know whether I told you about the Dorman Smith effort. The governor was Dorman Smith. And we went there on one riot when it was very, very serious. And these people, I thought I may have told you this, when they came up to the gates of the government house, and there were only a few of us in the band, and that was the only time we went out. But when these things occurred, the companies were sent to various strategic points with an interpreter. And people used to have these big banners in Burmese, in Hindustani, etc. Disperse or we fire. Well, what used to happen usually was they didn't disperse, and then there was a squadron of chaps. The first rank was said, "Kneel, load." And as soon as they loaded, they all ran away. But not always. And if they didn't, they had to fire around over their heads. Then we never had any trouble. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was always there, but the internal security duties were a bit of a bind because it disrupted the regiment's procedure, you know. Yeah. That's what we were there for, really, I suppose.
And how well did you get on with the Burmese people?
Very well, very well. Very nice people at that time. They were very... Well, they were when we went back years later, but they were very nice people. We didn't learn any Burmese at all. I had a great friend, Martha May, with whom I used to sing... Burmese girl, she died, and two chaps in their rover group, their rover scout group, used to come to my home, and we used to go to their home. They spoke English, that was a point. I never learned a word of Burmese at all, no.
Really?
No, I learned some Hindustani, I learned some Arabic, but never any, that was one of those things. I think it was because we had no reason to do so. We didn't mix with them like we did with the other people. We used to go into town on the bus. get it near the station, petrol station right outside the barracks, and it was a hoot because they'd stop at various places, and I think I may have told you, the women with their big cheroots, and they'd get off and light it up from this hanging tow rope, and they used to stink. Anyway, this went on, and then things began to get, it was obvious that it wasn't going to be very good for us. And it's always been one of my beefs that they didn't evacuate the families long before they did. And when they evacuated, and they evacuated them to Mamie with the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, who they mucked in with, you know. And my wife went, Julia went to a house with a lady, Kay, and she was expecting too, Kate, and she lost her baby just before Julie came away. And but we didn't know what was happening. They should have sent them out by ship long before that. However, they were in Mamie.
So when were they evacuated?
They went up there just before, in December 42.
So we're up to December 42, yes. Yeah.
And we knew nothing about what was happening at all. Okay? Nothing. And, of course, I used to write her letters, and she wrote back to me, and she was heavily pregnant at the time. And she said, we have air raids and we have to run to the slit trenches and so on. And my armour, her armour, the lady who was looking after the house, she was with Katie Gill. There they shared. Her husband was a great chap, Kay Vaughan, lovely man. And there was, when she wrote and told me that they'd been bombed as well, you know, because we hadn't been bombed at the time, but they were bombed up there. And the RSM's wife, very sadly, lost her baby. She lost her baby, Mrs. Niblett, and she didn't want to leave it there. She didn't want the Japanese to have her baby. It's, you know, it was. I only heard this afterwards, of course. And so time went by, and it was obvious that things were getting worse and worse. And I was now the mortar platoon sergeant. I had been on a course at Mamie for a month. I had never seen this weapon before, 3-inch mortar, with a man named Lieutenant Christensen and one of the corporals from the band, whose name's gone out of my mind at the moment. And we had this intense course, and we went back to the regiment, and we had to form a platoon, a mortar platoon. You need 4 men to a gun, and so we had 20 men. 4 sections for each gun we were going to get, and 1 section in reserve, just in case. We had no weapon. The men had never seen one. I mean, people will not believe this. We had never, we were the only 3 who'd seen one that had been sent to there specifically for the course. Well, honestly, it hurts me to say this, but everything in Burma at that time was geared to peacetime soldiering. There's no doubt about this. And how were we to train these men to fire these weapons? The pioneer sergeant made a base plate. It's 40 pounds in weight. It wasn't that heavy for these chaps. And we had bamboo things for the mortar. You know what I mean? And
the mortar tubes.
The tube, yes. The barrel. And he made the bipod. We explained what he had to do. So when they practice, the only chaps who were heavy were the base plate blokes, because the other things were made of bamboo. You take the point, do you? And it wasn't till 10 days before the Japanese came in that we got the weapons, you know, which didn't do us very good. And when they came and the chaps had to run 100 yards with 3 bombs in each hand, 60 pounds and 40 pounds base plate, barrel and bipod, they were knackered at the end of the day. They just, because it was intense, they had to be taught. Within 10 days, the Japs were there. However, I had a photo somewhere, I meant to bring it, but the governor came up, Dorman Smith from Rangoon, to see a demonstration. Ha, ha, ha. Well, they all knew what they had to do. The weapons came. We were worried to death because once you took the thing off, it could go off. Before you sort of had to let it go down the barrel, you see, and then it would go out. And I said to the chaps, just lay on. They had a basher. That's a little edifice made of bamboo and so on. We call them bashers, where we used to sleep sometimes. And they put this out in the field, 1,600 yards away. Well, that was the full range of this weapon. And I laid them on, and Lieutenant Christensen took the first two, and I took the next two, and they fired, and they all fell short, which wasn't unusual in those days. And so we reduced it to 1,400 yards, and one blow hit it straight on the knob. That's how lucky we were. So the regiment were all in attendance, by the way, to see what they were going to be backed up with. We were chuffed, of course, and even Colonel Baggett said, what do you think about it, Metcalf? I said, it was a fluke, sir, because while we were on the range up there, we never really got on the target. But every time the bomb hit the ground, it would swathe for 100 yards all round it. It was a terrible weapon, really. Thank God that the Japanese had ones that used to go pop, and it went right up in the air. But that's another story. However, we were suddenly sent into cell barracks. Cell barracks were the barracks in Rangoon near the Sri Dagon Pagoda.
How do you
spell that? S-A-L-E, cell barracks. And, we didn't know why we'd gone there. And the colonel came round and said, we'll probably evacuate very soon, as soon as we get instructions. And I suddenly went down with dysentery, the first time I'd ever really well had it, and it wasn't very pleasant in my truck. But the following morning, the Japanese were coming up the river in their boats, and we had to evacuate with 20 miles of civilian convoy, if you please. We were the escorting people to bring them out of Burma.
Right, so who was in the civilian convoy?
Yeah.
Who was that? Was that all British civilians?
Lots. Who would they be? Civil servants, government staff, anyone appertaining to the British crown, you know what I mean? Which was quite a lot of people, quite frankly. I mean, Rangoon was big.
Yeah. And they were, a convoy was what? Was it lorries?
Yes, yes, and that's another story.
Yeah.
Well, mostly lorries. And that's, the point is, we used to get lorries coming in to take to China. They used to go up the Burma Road and up to Lado. I took one on one occasion, and I was frightened to death because the Chinese had actually built this road between two mountains, literally thousands of them with soil and stones, and quite a lot of trucks went over the side because it wasn't very strong. However, that's another story, I'm sorry, but we had, when the trucks came in, of course, when we couldn't take them up there, they were stacked in the ordnance depot. So otherwise, we would have had to march out of Burma. I mean, I didn't know how to drive a truck at the time. I soon learned, I'll tell you that.
So how did you get the alarm that the Japanese were coming up the river?
I couldn't tell you. Mm. I couldn't. All I know is that we were moved out very quickly.
Right.
Very quickly. Yeah. I say very quickly because we were on the road within minutes.
Really?
Within minutes, we were on the road. We didn't even know the Japanese were coming up there at that time. It was soon, we had two companies at Sirium, which was the oil depot across the river. And they were there 2 days after, by the way. They came up to, we were fortunate we ever got them back. But that wasn't the main body.
I'll stop you just there.
Yeah.
Harold Morris Metcalf, end of Reel 8.